Well, good evening, everyone. We're so glad to be here with you for this Answers in Energy speaker series. We have an absolutely fantastic speaker here with us today, Steve Solomon, the well-known and author, most recently, of Water, The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization. As you know, the Answer in Energy speaker series is dedicated to addressing issues of energy, natural resources, and environmental law and policy here in the United States and worldwide. Answers in Energy is a part of the University of Tulsa Law School, and particularly our Master's in Jurisprudence in Energy Law. It is a degree program that's open both to lawyers and non-lawyers alike who need specialized education in energy, natural resources, and environmental law to further their goals, their lives, and their careers. The Answer in Energy speaker series is, in fact, part of one of the formal classes for the Master of Jurisprudence in Energy Law, a class that we call Thesis Development Laboratory. And for those of you who are attending this series live but aren't yet one of our students, you are in the University of Tulsa Law's online classroom. I have with me Rick Munoz. Rick is the professor of Energy Laboratory. Say hi, Rick.
Hello, and I'd like to welcome everyone in who may be listening for the first time. And the way the class works, as Jason mentioned, is that these webinars serve as a forum for issues to come up that students will build their thesis on. So we're very excited about this process and welcome to everyone who's with us today.
You probably noticed a little beep in the background there. I needed to turn my email off so that every time we get an email message, it doesn't tell the whole world that. But you'll notice that there are other folks here in the classroom with you. And many of these folks are candidates for a formal master's degree. They're Rick's students. Many others are University of Tulsa alumni. Now, in the upper left-hand corner of your screen, you should see a chat box. There's a little residual from our setup a few minutes ago. But when you have questions, please go ahead and type them in there. And then towards the end of the program, Rick or I will ask those questions for you. Or Steve, since you're sitting right there, you'll be able to see them as well. And you're welcome to just pick them off and answer them. So,
sure.
Without really any further ado, I'd like one more moment to be indulged. I'd like to give Steve a proper introduction before we get started. Stephen Solomon is a well-known author, and he's written for The New York Times, Business Week, The Economist, Forbes, and Esquire. He's a regular commentator on NPR's Marketplace and has appeared as a featured guest on the late CBS Evening News, BBC TV, The Morning Joe, Travis Smiley, Tim Russert's CNBC show, Al Jazeera, Fox News, The Diane Rehm Show, NPR's Talk of the Nation, All Things Considered and the World, Larry Mantle's Air Talk, The Jim Bohannon Show, Bloomberg TV, and various other news programs. He has addressed the Carnegie Council, the Wilson Center, the Center for Strategic International Studies, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the Nature Conservancy, the U.S. Department of Defense, the World Affairs Council, Zocalo, Public Square, NYU's Law and Security Institute, the LA Times Book Festival, and has delivered numerous keynotes at water industry groups and university forums. And we are so proud to have Steve here on our Answers to Energy program. Steve is the author, as I'd mentioned earlier, of Water, The Epic Struggle for Wealth, Power, and Civilization, which was a finalist for the prestigious Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and The Confidence Game, an insider account of the global financial policymaking where he presciently warned about the building dangers of the volatile, interlinked financial system. Steve's working on a new book that I understand, The Mississippi River and the Making of America, Past, Present, and Future. Steve, we're just thrilled to have you. Thank you so much for taking your time today. And I should let you all know that Steve is joining us through this classroom from Washington, D.C., while we're here in Tulsa, and all of you are wherever you are. Thank you for being here, Steve.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
So let me get us started off with a question. As we go through, I may ask a question or Rick may ask one. But Steve, you know, with that background, I'm really interested. How did you become interested in writing about water and about energy issues?
Well, my background is a little eclectic, and it comes from a sort of an economic and business background. I started out at Forbes magazine as a journalist, and therefore was in business. Gravitated over to finance and the economy, hence the book on the global financial system. But I've always had an abiding interest in world history, and really came to water because I was trying to find a vehicle to get through all those world history books on my shelf that I've never read, and trying to find a vehicle to do so. And I had an example of a friend of mine, Dan Yergin, who did a book on oil, and I was trying to come up with a resource that could be as important throughout history, perhaps, as oil, or maybe even more so. And I discovered, of course, water, which was the original and most important resource, exceeding even oil, except perhaps in the last 100 years. And now we find, of course, there's a great convergence between the two. So my framework, just to reiterate, is less from a classical environmental standpoint, and I do tend to see the environment a bit in economic terms. And so that's my particular bias in looking at political economy.
Well, thanks. You have
that's it.
Stephen, you have written an absolutely fantastic book. I actually have a copy of it here. I met you at the Oklahoma Water Resources Board's annual meeting this last year and was so thrilled to get your book. I was wondering kind of if you could describe for those maybe who haven't yet had a chance to read the book kind of the sweep of your research.
Sure. Well, when you start to look at water in world history, you find that water is the one indispensable resource that has helped to define whether civilizations were able to rise and survive or whether they often declined. And you go back to the origin of what we call civilization, that is the agricultural revolution, and that was based on the manipulation of water for mass-scale irrigation. Of course, we've always used water for drinking purposes, but we've also used it for transport as well. And in time, people began to also to use it for energy. When you sort of fast forward throughout history, you come to the second great revolution in civilization's history, and that is the Industrial Revolution, which was really based on the harnessing of steam power. The ways in which water interacts with our lives is so extensive that it is almost impossible to disaggregate. And whenever societies have managed to harness water resources for the four basic purposes that we've used it for, they've tended to prosper. And when they have been unable to maintain the infrastructures or been insufficient in harnessing that resource, they've tended to not do so well. So I argue in the book that the rise and decline of civilizations is often reflected in and also driven partly by how well they harness their water resources.
That's really interesting.
I'll take the example of the United States. We can, yeah. If you for those who are familiar with U.S. history, I mean, we have three. In China, I'll just give you some other examples. I mean, I go back to the original four irrigation societies, which we would say is Egypt, along the Nile, mm-hmm. The Euphrates, Tigris rivers in Mesopotamia, the Indus River, and, of course, the Yellow River in China as the original civilizations. China managed in the Middle Ages to become the most advanced civilization when it created the Grand Canal, which was about 1,000 miles length. Being able to bring resources from the wet south, where they had surplus of rice, to the dry north, where they were unable to produce enough food to maintain armies. If you look at the rise even of the United States in our time, we've had three really hydrological regions in the United States. We've had the East Coast, which was the eastern half of the United States, which was wet and temperate, and had lots of small rivers that were both good for water power and were good for transportation. And we developed our resources in that region first. We also had seascapes that were very good for navigation, and we we're a trading nation, and when the Panama Canal came, obviously we linked the resources of the East and the West together, and that accelerated our growth. And when you look at the arid lands of the West, we faced a whole other problem there, in that you needed a large-scale irrigation, and that we achieved with the multipurpose dams that started at Hoover, which included irrigation, it included flood control, and it included generations of large amounts of electricity. And by successfully harnessing our water resources in these three ways and linking them together, that has sustained a great deal of our economic vitality.
That is really fascinating. I was wondering, in your research, when did the link between, you know, in time, when did the link between water and energy begin to become apparent to you?
Yeah. I would say, and just to step back from that question, the first thing is that the matrimony of interdependence between water and energy has been increasingly deepening. But it really begins, I would say, with the key invention was the water wheel, which was harnessing just the power of the stream flow, mostly to grind grain. And there were improvements made in that. And the ones among the major improvements were the vertical water wheel, which places which the water can flow from on top and turn the wheel in a fashion like, I don't know if anybody can see my finger, but it's like this, upside down instead of horizontally, sideways, which increased the amount of energy that it was able to produce. And that starts really with the couple centuries before Christ. The Romans took advantage of that. The Chinese were also very advanced in their water use. And that was the major source of energy, and helped inaugurate, in fact, the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, back even in Europe in the 12th, 13th century. And it also powered the iron, the forges, exactly, yeah, sorry. So I'm going to put the right word here. To power the forges that were able to make the, to pour the iron. And that really got Europe going very well. And it also, in China, they were actually starting with some early factories in making silk looms and such. But if you think about the early factories, even in England, these were all water-powered factories. And even in the 19th century, in Lowell, Massachusetts, here in the United States, we were taking advantage of water power to make those textile mills go. So that, for really 2,000 years, water power was it. I mean, in terms of the main source of water and energy. Since then, of course, it's multiplied in so many different ways. We use water even in mining operations, of course, to produce in producing oil, for example. We used hydropower for generating electricity. We also, I often say, we should step back for 1 minute and say, if you look where we are today, we use tremendous amounts of energy to move water to where we want it, because water is we need huge amounts of water for all the things that we do with it, whether it's cooling power plants, or whether it's for industry, or whether to produce food. We need vast amounts of energy, so there's this interdependence between the two. We also use all this water to produce the energy itself. Even when we think about desal plants in the going forward in the future, the big limitation on desal is the energy cost. And the pumping of the water once you get it onto land to where we want it to go. So there are many interdependencies.
Yeah, you know, going back to your book, you have these absolutely great pictures in your book. And now I read your book and I didn't just look at the pictures, I promise. But but looking at some of these, you know, I was looking at Archimedes, a picture you have of an Archimedes screw and a picture of a Noria, and some of the, you just mentioned the need to lift water in order to be able to use it in agriculture. It seems that the water is both a source of energy and a way in which energy is consumed and used in our society. Is that fair?
Absolutely. It's growing deeper all the time in those connections. And that's why we have to manage water and energy as an interdependent resource at this point. And right now, one of the big problems that we face in the world is that we are treating them still separately and trying to make them make incremental improvements quite detached from one another. And that is clearly a flawed strategy given the world that we live in. But to go back to your point, the Archimedes screw, which was basically a large corkscrew encased in a cylinder that was laid in a stream, and then a crank was turned, and it lifted the water up maybe 5 to 7 feet, which could get it enough to the agricultural fields where gravity energy would then help to irrigate the fields. And that was important to producing a second crop or a second season of crop or a little extra, which was often, in most of history, enough between to make the difference between starvation and survival. The Noria was using animal power, where they just marched around in a circle with a basically almost like gourds that would be dipped into the water and then lift them up into the same purpose. To, you know, where you guys are located, and we've had the Dust Bowl, you know, in the 1930s, and the solution to the Dust Bowl turned out to be, among other things, the ability to drill for water in the Ogallala Aquifer that helped to turn that into a cornucopia of productive farmland. Obviously, there were a lot of soil management practices involved as well. But that region on the 98th to 100th parallel was the dividing line for most of our history about where we could sustain agriculture based on rain only. And once we've got the technology to use oil and diesel to drill for oil, to drill for water, we were kind of stuck on that limit.
Yeah? Well, you know, and going back to this historical sweep for a minute, you know, we talked about the water wheel, and we've talked about these early devices, the Archimedes screw and the Noria. I was wondering, too, you know, it seems to me that water played an enormous step in the early industrial revolution beyond the water wheel with the steam engine as well.
Right. That was the big breakthrough, of course. James Watt did the improved steam engine. And that's water in another form. We discovered pressure from steam, and were able to vastly to move a piston up and down, and we were vastly able to increase the amount of horsepower that we were able to generate from steam. And we invented turbines, which also were efficient mechanisms that improved further the horsepower that we could generate from this. And that's what launched the Industrial Revolution, was steam. I mean, after all, it was steam and iron in combination with one another, because once you could had greater energy, you could produce more amounts of iron and steel. And we know where all that led. So that was correctly seen as one of the perhaps the greatest single invention of the millennia. At least the Economist magazine called it that in one of their special 2000 editions, and I don't disagree.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was struck when I was reading your book, in page 329 in your book, you make this statement which really, really struck me. You said, what changed everything was the Hoover, a.k.a. Boulder Dam. And, you know, I read that line and I was thinking about what we do here in Tulsa, and I was thinking about the West, and it just absolutely struck me. And I was wondering if you could expand on that. What changed everything was the Hoover Dam.
Well, the Hoover Dam was the first giant multipurpose dam. And by multipurpose, I'm talking about it did flood control. It did irrigation on a mass scale, and it produced vast amounts of energy, electricity, that really allowed the accelerated development of that region of the country, of the Southwest. We had, of course, the Grand Coulee was even larger up in the Northwest. And by the way, parenthetically, a nice story about that one. You know, there was a lot of controversy when FDR wanted to build the Grand Coulee Dam, mm-hmm. which he did with sort of private funds that he was able to control against the strong objections of many in Congress who thought it was wasteful spending because we would never use so much electricity because mm-hmm. it produced so much more than we were using it the whole time in the whole country. And by the time it started up the Grand Coulee, and he fought, you know, rear guard actions, and he got it through. And when it came through, it was about 6 days after Pearl Harbor, and when we needed vast amounts of hydroelectricity to be able to smelt aluminum to be able to produce all the airplanes that helped us fight back against the Japanese. So I take from that a lesson that a good invention will find good uses in time. But the Hoover Dam was the first of what are now 50,000 to 60,000 giant dams that have been built around the world. And these have transformed the 20th century, the second half of the 20th century. It facilitated the Green Revolution. Could not have happened without the marshaling of so much water for both for irrigation and for electricity purposes. And we went from a population in the world of 1.5 billion to 6 billion in the 20th century without mass starvation, which was really an unprecedented event and highly unforeseen, I would say, even as late as the 1950s. The water was needed to accompany, of course, the other breakthroughs that were made in hybridization and et cetera and fertilizer. But it was the interaction of those three. Today you have half those giant dams, by the way, are still in China. We're still building them at a very furious rate to produce large amounts of energy, primarily for hydroelectricity. And they are doing so because they've only exploited about 40 or 45% of their hydroelectricity capacity, and they are using their advantages on the Tibetan plateau, which they occupy somewhat controversially, to dam the rivers of Asia up there to produce the energy that's going to be able to allow them to grow, although many of the downriver states are a little bit nervous about what that's going to mean for them. There are parts of the world today that are still in deep poverty, like Africa is only using 10% of its hydroelectric capacity at this point. Pakistan only about 30% or so. So there are still vast opportunities in the world for us to exploit the advantages of these giant dams. And Hoover was the prototype that that showed us that it was all possible.
Stephen, this is Rick. I have a question in relation to, first of all, I want to say that your research indicating the centrality of water to civilization itself, I think, is eye-opening and profound, and I want to thank you for your work on that. It's I think, very stimulating to think in those terms.
Thank you.
And in light of the fact that your research has shown how important water is to civilization, what, from what you've come across, what do you think the key is from a policy and social and legal framework that successful societies have had in terms of harnessing water? Is it just that they've serendipitously fallen into it, or has it been a culture of innovation that seems to have fostered the development of water? And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my observation, and which is admittedly kind of broad brush here, but I've noticed that very often a lot of the great water infrastructures are built at the beginning of new dynasties. What you often see, for example, the Grand Canal in China was built within 10 or 15, was completed within 10 or 15 years by the great energy of a new dynasty that arose. Mm-hmm. It was all done very rapidly. 5 million people died building it. Wow. But it then sustained the civilization for several hundred years and then fell into disrepair. You see the same pattern in Egypt, which went through three ancient dynasties in the ancient times, and even later on, you can actually look at Aswan Dam as a part of the same pattern of dynasties that rise when they build new infrastructures, live off the infrastructures, then decline, often collapse, mm-hmm. and then get revitalized or conquered. So I don't think it goes, unfortunately, in a nice smooth pattern. It mm-hmm. usually goes in a kind of herky-jerky motion when we reach a crisis, which I would say we're pretty close to reaching in our own country by our neglect of our infrastructure, and whether we can marshal our energies or not to take advantage, because America has an enormous competitive advantage in water in the world today that we are just squandering, in my opinion. But in other parts of the world, like in China, as I say, they certainly are trying, and they are building a new dynasty out in China. You could almost look at it that way. Hmm. So it happens often like that, rather than in any... it would be nice if we could capture it in a bottle and have a process of innovation, which we somewhat have today. Obviously, the private market is a great is a great vehicle for giving you some continuous a mechanism that doesn't rely on some central government policy people to get together all their. To get to all the elements that are necessary. So I'm a big fan of trying to do as much of this as you can within the in the private sector. But of course, the challenges require a public-private coordination, really.
Sure. Well, one thing I'd like to mention to the students out there who may be interested in water for your thesis paper. You might consider looking at legal frameworks, both historically and contemporary frameworks that promote the utilization of water and those that don't. That, I think that sounds like it would be an area that would be
And from a legal standpoint, I would say, yeah. And I would add on that on point, that if you, for any students who are interested in that, the 19th century, there, if you look at Europe in the 19th century, a lot of these were farmed out to private groups. A lot of the what we would call public infrastructure programs today. And in the 20th century, government took over the leadership gradually in this field. And even today, we see efforts made. Sometimes we do subsidies and that kind of thing, but it's still everybody's really looking to the government to be the chief funder of this. I do think we are at a stage where we need a new paradigm for how we manage our water resources, in part because the government-led model has sort of exhausted its ability to produce the kind of wealth that we were able to produce in the 20th century. And I do think some of these discussions around public-private partnerships might be a fruitful avenue to look at.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Well, that leads me to a question I wanted to ask. Steve, you indicated that the U.S. has this competitive advantage with water today that we may not be really utilizing to its best advantage. I was wondering if you might expand on that.
Sure. Well, first of all, there's great water scarcity in the world today. That's one of the thesis of the of this book, too. In the fourth part of this book on water, we talk about the global water scarcity crisis, which is quite severe around the world. We have 7 billion people rising to 9 or 10 billion, and not only do people lack enough for drinking, there are large parts of the world that are not going to be able to feed themselves that are doing so today because they don't have enough water even for their agriculture. Now, there's a lot of water that's wasted. But in the scale of things in the world, the United States is one of the water-richest countries in the world. We have something like 8% of the world's water and only 4% of the world's population. China has one-fifth the amount per capita that we do and has a worse imbalance between its very arid north and its wet south than we do in between our wet and regions and our arid regions. And it's true that in some regions, like the western portions of the United States, we are definitely stressed at the moment. There's a lot that we could do, even in those regions, to make ourselves, to get more productive use out of the water that we have. But we have a great quantity of water in the in the wet regions, the Mississippi, which I'm writing about right now. And we are doing absolutely nothing to maximize the productivity of our water use, or I wouldn't say absolutely nothing, almost nothing, to maximize the advantages. Now, here's the advantage. In this water-scarce world, people in countries throughout the Middle East, it'll soon be true in India and Pakistan, are going to have to import large volumes of food. Now, food is another name for virtual water. That is, the amount of food that you or I consume in a given day for our meals is about 4 tons worth of water goes into the food we eat each day. But we can't move all that water to grow the food, but we can move the food, right? The same is true of the energy that we are producing and many of the industrial goods that we are producing. A lot of places in the world don't have enough water, take Iraq, for example, to produce the energy that they need to be able to have a viable economy. We produce a lot of energy, and that a lot of energy goes into producing goods. These are exportable items that both can redound to our economic growth and wealth, but also to meet the needs of a very water-starved world population that is going to have increasing turmoil and failing states, in some cases, from their scarcity of water and inability to produce the things that water is needed for. So we are sitting on a resource that we take for granted so much that we don't even really recognize that it is one of our comparative advantages.
That's fascinating.
That really is. I mean, it makes me really kind of come to this question that you and I have chatted about briefly before, this question of energy justice. And so many people in the world, 2.6 billion of them, lack access to adequate energy resources. And what you're saying is that there's a major link between that and the availability of water.
Yeah, of course. You take the case of, take the example of Iraq for a minute. Iraq is, we've put so much time and treasure and blood into and money into that country and trying to resurrect a society in the post-Saddam world there. But they are unable to run many of their multi-purpose dams for irrigation and for energy purposes because there's not enough water in the Euphrates River because it's taken out upstream by Turkey and, until recently, Syria. And those three countries, just to give an example, have water projects planned that will use 1.5 times the total volume of water in that river. And that's a physical impossibility. So the downstream country in that case, which is Iraq, and it is in the most vulnerable position to the upstream nations and doesn't have an equalizer in terms of its military power or such to balance the equation. And so they are suffering with blackouts, with power that is, insufficient for refrigeration, for example. And the same is true in Pakistan as well on the Indus River, which is why that country is one of the reasons why that country is having such a difficult time and why when the United States gave its aid to Pakistan under the Kerry-Lugar bill, a large portion of it, maybe over 50% of it, was focused on water and energy projects that were interrelated with one another. Hmm. And to the credit of the of Senator Clinton when she was Secretary of State, I mean, she recognized for the first time that water was a critical element that affected all the goals of our diplomatic policy, and she elevated water to the top rank of U.S. policy considerations, the window by which we look through how people are doing in terms of their economies, in terms of their human rights, survival needs for irrigation, but also she looked at the women's rights because very often it's women who are the water carriers in these countries. I mean, I was in Kenya, and the women were spent, maybe women and children largely, would spend 4 to 5 hours each day collecting water from a clean source in jerry cans and carry it back physically in their hands or on bicycles or on animals to their villages. And that means that these folks were not having time for education, not having time to grow a little extra patch of vegetables. And these are really dirt poor people. And, you know, just by putting in some, which we did in this case, we're able to put in some pipelines that allowed the pumps, which were lifting the water from the wells, to pump it to their villages. They suddenly got, you know, freed up their entire day for some other kind of work. I mean, it was a major change in their lives. And it was something very simple and very, very inexpensive to do, but was never being done because of really political failures.
Well, Steve, my thought...
It cost us like $5,000 to do that, yeah.
Yeah, changing people's entire lives.
One thought I have, Steve, and I'd like to get your impressions on if you think this would be a fruitful pursuit for the students. I think it might be interesting for a thesis to think about the linkage between water scarcity and political and legal instability. It sounds like that would be a fascinating pursuit. What are your thoughts?
Political instability for sure. We see states like Yemen, which we consider to be a failed state, is the also one of the most is really has run out of water. It's really the first state to have done so. You see, we have all the prisoners in Guantanamo prison. We're unable to bring them back to Yemen because it's considered to be a failed state, and they'll just simply re-enter the terrorist network. Right. Well, what the backstory there is that. The countryside, people have been having to leave the countryside of Yemen because they are, the water is not being able to be used, what water they have they're running out of water, but they're also using it for narcotic crop instead of for growing crops. But people are leaving the countryside and going into them and pouring into the cities there, which is the society's falling apart. Al-Qaeda is digging some of the wells to help some of the peasants and try to win their hearts and minds there. But this country is literally run out of water, and the major city there, Sana'a, is a very high city. It's about 3,000 or so. I may be wrong on the feet, but 3,000 or more feet, which is very hard to pump the water up from lower and lower levels there when they need the energy to do that. In Syria, we saw before the civil war was in part triggered by a long drought in that region that caused, again, all the farmers to have to leave their farms in the northeast section and to become internal migrants, and we are beginning to see internal and trans-border migrations between states, in part because of water problems, water shortages, sometimes exacerbated by climate change, but often by failed government policies. And maybe underlying that are water rights and water practice law, although I think very often it's a matter of enforcement as well, and simple governance. And so the linkages are very direct, are expanding to critical countries around the globe that are going to affect not just the state of life in those countries, but their neighbors and even us in the United States. So it's a very germane question.
Fascinating. Thank you.
I'd also like to point out one other thing. Even in our United States, we are projecting our own energy needs based on the Department of Energy to be greatly accelerated. I think there's a 30 or 50% needs and increase in electricity, depending on the time frame you're looking at. And many of the new technologies that we are relying on to achieve these energy goals are very water intensive. They are actually more water intensive than the traditional energy sources like oil production. And there have been studies done by Sandia Labs and others, national labs, and the Department of Energy's under the Department of Energy's. They were kind of forced into doing it by some congressmen and some of these departments that are suggesting that we may not have enough water in some areas to be able to meet those energy goals. So we have to start looking at these at the energy needs in terms of the water availability. And the big one, of course, is the one of the big ones is the shale revolution.
Yeah,
which has great potential, you know. And if we you look at that, I mean, well, the shale is several 3 to 5 times more water intensive than in most cases than simple traditional oil production. And until we come up with a way to find that water, and a lot of this these are in arid regions. You look what's going up in the Bakken Shale. They're trucking in huge amounts of water in tankers. It's not a viable long-term solution. It's a bottleneck. So hopefully, and there is some signs that we are beginning to develop some ways of reusing the produced water from some of these hydrofract wells over and over again. It's an early technology, and it's got a long way to go yet, but we're showing some signs that maybe that will be the breakthrough that allows us to break that bottleneck in particular. But there are others in solar and in whatever. We can go down the list of technologies of energy that we have, that we're relying on.
You're making me want to go stock up on water.
Well, yeah, I'll
tell you, the water.
Go ahead, Steve.
Water stocks are doing pretty well.
Yeah, they really are. You know, that it really brings up a question. This concept of reuse of water for fracking brings to my mind a question of, can water scarcity be a reason for energy conservation? And other than that example with fracking, do you have any other kind of thoughts or ideas about that?
Well, first of all, of course, the answer is yes. So that's a market force eventually. So many corporations, just to stay out of energy just for directly for 1 minute, but even take General Electric, which has become aware of the energy-water nexus quite clearly and is a leader, frankly, in trying to use to use water more efficiently to save energy costs. Because cooling water, you know, is you can save a lot of money by reusing cooling water or using hybrid techniques, for example, between dry cooling and wet cooling for solar in some areas. So where water is scarce, obviously, you know, not only does the price go up, but the politics get hot too, because when the Obama administration was starting out with this idea for solar in the Southwest, it seemed like a kind of a no-brainer, right?
Right.
But suddenly they realized all the amount of water that they were going to need to cool the power plants, and that suddenly got all the farmers and everybody else who uses the water up in arms, and they said, wait a minute, we don't want to compete over there. So that is a huge incentive for conservation. And some companies that have the ability to do so are beginning to consider recycling on site of their reusing the water. Hold on to the water that they got rather than simply take it from the central source, use all the energy to ship it back there and then pump it back and, you know, do the larger cycle. Keep it on site and do a wastewater treatment right on their own site. And many of these wastewater treatment plants, I hasten to add, are at least the public ones, are able to produce enough energy from the waste and the sludge of the city's waste to be able to not only acquire all the energy they need to power their own wastewater treatment plants, but actually sell a surplus energy back to the grids. So there are some, and here the lawyers are not helping, because many of them are fussing that is an illegal and unwanted source of extra energy to the monopolies that are ruling the roost right now. So, but that's a role for the lawyers to help sort that one out so that we can be logical and sensible in our water policy. So that's one area and an obvious one in which eventually the cost, the scarcity will produce some movement to conservation. And we have, I mean, look, starting in the 1970s, across the industrialized world, starting with the environmental laws, particularly looking at the use of water for, we have increased the productivity of our water use. We increased in the United States water use relative to increased three times faster than our population in the first 75 years of the 20th century. Since then, we have flatlined in our total use of water resources, more or less, and our population has continued to grow. So we've had about a 30% productivity increase. That's a historic break from world history and even from the rest of the world, which is still consuming water at twice the rate of population growth. So that is very encouraging. And the thing that really helped trigger that was the concern about that the water pollution that was being generated, a lot of it from the heated water that was going back in through the once cooling systems of the power plants into the rivers and disrupting much of the ecosystem life there, led to breakthroughs in doing recycling that that cooling water as one of the first triggers. So the environmental laws, in effect, put a cost on an environmental cost on the use of that water, and that itself stimulated innovation and conservation that has accrued to the benefit of everybody, including economic growth. You and I discussed previously in some other time, I believe in-stream flows also, which are necessary to preserve the basic health of an ecosystem, and have been given legal status in Australia, parts of California, and increasingly in Europe and increasingly in the United States, other parts of the United States, will also stimulate a more efficient use of the water resources, whether it be for energy as it competes with urban uses and competes with industrial uses. But as scarcity, you know, once there's a limitation on the amount of the water that's available, either you can let it go to the highest value use, or you got to come up with a regime that at least shares the water in a way that meets the multiple needs of a society.
Sure. Sure. So you have been really kind to us, and I think we're kind of coming near the end of our time, because I don't want to take you away from the rest of your life too much longer. But when we were talking earlier in preparation for meeting this evening, you had mentioned to me kind of a dynamic involving four elements that you see as a kind of a primary method of viewing many of these issues of water or energy or food or climate, environmental right. sustainability. And I was wondering if you wouldn't mind sharing that idea sure. with the group, because I thought that was really interesting.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I messed up on my phone. Wait 1 second.
It's fine.
That's quite all right.
You know, life happens, and okay. It's important to make sure that
I meant to put the phone in the other room, but I don't know how to turn it off. Anyway, here's what I want to say about that. There have been four uses in world history. Today, there's a fifth use that we've made of water. The four uses in the past have been for domestic use, that is for drinking and sanitation. It's been for economic purposes, which is agriculture and industry. It's been for transportation purposes, and it's been for energy purposes. That have been the four general categories that we have used water for pretty much for everything that we've needed. Today, however, given the scarcity problems of the world and the fact that we are so overtaxing many of the vital ecosystems that produce the water, like 70 of our major rivers are so overused that they no longer even reach the sea any longer, and that includes like the Colorado River, that we now need to allocate water for environmental environmental purposes, what I call in-stream flows. For you have the Ogallala Aquifer out there in the center of the United States. For a long time, it was being pumped in some parts of the Ogallala. It's still being pumped without regard to its long-term availability, and it's being overpumped to the point that it is now going to become empty. Well, obviously, the moment it becomes empty, you face the same sort of conditions you face into the Dust Bowl, and the cornucopia is used up. Well, the same thing is problem when you damage ecosystems to such a degree that they can no longer produce the water that we all need for our for all the uses that we get of it, you've got to obviously protect the source. So this is a fifth new use that we are now having to include in the 21st century going forward. So I'm saying that we really need a new paradigm in how we manage water. And the nation that develops that paradigm, there is a pretty good consensus about a lot of the elements, and there are places where it is being developed to some degree, will be nations that do well and do better than others. And those that do not are going to face the kind of failed state scenarios, the water have-nots of the world, live in the poverty and with the disease and the short lifespans that we all wish wouldn't happen. But we are facing a very difficult transition, as we have in other times in history, where a vital resource is out of line with the population growth and the demands of a world for a middle-class lifestyle, which is even more water-intensive than simply the straight-line arithmetic increase in population. So, to summarize, there are four vital uses and have always been in world history, and today we've got to answer a fifth in how we integrate the needs, the water needs of the economy, of the environment that produces and sustains that water resource, as a fifth new use.
Well, Steve, I think you ought to get a sip of water, because I hear a crack in your voice. That was amazing, and I think that concept of looking at the world through that lens is a really, really valuable thing for us all
to
have heard.
And I would like just to add, I must say, you're in Oklahoma, and I would say this for those who are in Oklahoma. I was very impressed when I came out to talk to your officials in Oklahoma, and I was a little ignorant of it beforehand, I confess. You have one of the most progressive water policies in the state of Oklahoma that I hope other states in the United States will look to as they should do state water budgets, begin to do a stakeholder process to develop a water plan going forward for the long term, and one that does not require, in the state of Oklahoma, I believe you have are planning on using about the same amount of water that you do today, that you will use in 2060. And if that is achieved, Oklahoma will be a prosperous, will increase its chances of being a very prosperous region of the United States. I wish some of your neighbors were imitating what you're doing out there.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. You know, we do have some of our neighbors looking to stick a straw in us, as it were. The you know, you point out that Oklahoma has progressive roots, and we do. You know, going kind of all the way back. One of our most famous writers and authors, he might have coined the phrase that whiskey's for drinking, but water's for fighting over. And you,
I thought that was Mark Twain, but okay.
Is that Mark Twain? Oh, it was Mark Twain. Mark Twain. I'm sorry, but you taught me one. Yeah, well, you're writing about the Mississippi, so you would know. You taught me one the other day, though, and that was that water flows uphill to power, and I'd never heard that before.
That's right. That's an old one.
Go ahead. Tell me about it. Tell me about the history. I was wondering if you'd tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it's an old statement, but I mean, wherever you look in the world, this point was made to me actually by one of the great, really guy, a really great water expert who spent his life working in water in the developing world. But it's true. If you think about wherever there is water resources, you will find that the wealthy and powerful interests usually have the best access to the best water. They'll live in places that are, that can get access to it for the needs that they have, whether it be for consumption purposes or for industry. I'll give you an example of Los Angeles, the great famous case of Los Angeles grabbing the water from the Owens Valley in the Sierra Nevadas, and that water flowed over mountains.
The movie you're talking about was documented.
Chinatown. Chinatown was based loosely on that story.
Yeah.
You'll see when you build great dams. Very often and this is one of the reasons why there is such skepticism and hostility to building large dams around the world by many people, is that very often the lands that get flooded are the poor people's lands, and the benefits from the from these giant dams usually flow to the industries, the agribusinesses, the cities, and leave the others really uncompensated or undercompensated, as the case may be. But you also see it in people who live alongside of rivers, in the lowlands that get flooded, versus the people who live on the hills that are just outside the floodplains. I mean, where would you rather live? Mm-hmm. And one way or the other, where the money is, you can find the direction that the water flows. My editor at Forbes, my first editor at Forbes, taught me, you want to get to the bottom of the story, follow the money. Well, it's the same to follow the money and the water go in the same direction.
Well, that's fantastic.
It's not a surprise. It's an old story.
Yeah, it makes sense. You know, with that point, I'd like to open this up for a few minutes to questions, to see if anyone would like to ask a question or two. I'm going to disappear from the screen here for a second so that I can run the computer and help in that regard. But let's just take one moment here.
And one thing I'd like to mention while we're waiting for the questions to come up is that when Steve mentioned earlier about the need for a new paradigm, and so for the students in thinking about your thesis, when you start talking about new paradigms, you're talking about public policy and legal frameworks that promote the new paradigm or essentially create it. And he also mentioned Oklahoma, too. So what students who are interested might think about exploring Oklahoma's approach to water usage and extrapolate on the elements of that approach that could be used on a national or international level. So that'd be, I think, an excellent subject matter for a thesis.
And I would also point out, in Oklahoma, you have a new director. I'll get his title wrong, but I know you've put the Environment and Energy Department, I think, together under a new gentleman who comes from the Army Corps of Engineers.
That's right, Secretary Teague.
Who has an excellent reputation from what I can ascertain, and certainly I had a conversation with him when I was in Oklahoma and was impressed with him there, to understanding, again, the possibility of not subordinating one to the other, but actually making the two complement each other and recognizing the interdependency between those resources. I'll point out also, from a legal framework, that we have a checkerboard of 50 different states, and we have almost no continuity in our water law. Our water policy at a national level is a complete jigsaw, and you have even water rights are considered differently in the West and the East part of the United States, with overlapping differences and special cases in between. So if anybody can come up with a way to help us harmonize any of that, it would be great, because water doesn't stay within states. You know, it flows in basins that are transnational and trans-state, whatever the word is I'm looking for there. I think you know what I mean, trans-province. So there's a enormous opportunity for legal minds to get involved and hopefully come up with some kind of rationalizing mechanisms that the politicians can help the politicians solve this problem.
Absolutely. Steve, I'm going to pass the microphone here to Matthew Pike, who's one of our master's students, who is, in of all places, Happy Valley, Goose Bay, and Labrador, Canada.
All right. As Jason pointed out, I live in Newfoundland and Labrador on the far east coast of Canada, and we have large-scale hydro available for export. However, many of the states have renewable portfolio standards that do not allow large-scale hydro to be counted towards achieving the RPS goals. But the benefits I see in this is that states would be able to benefit from hydropower without having the environmental impact of constructing a dam, which seems to be the big stop to most new hydro dams. In your opinion, should states reconsider disallowing large-scale hydro imports to Canada to be counted towards achieving their renewable portfolio standard goals?
I'll confess that I'm not an expert on this particular issue, but the way you phrase it and the way you frame it, it certainly sounds that they ought to. The relation between Canada and the United States on water is very complicated, as you may know, and Canadians are quite passionate about their water resources and afraid that somehow the United States is going to take advantage of those water resources. So there's a strong movement not to export the water resources in either direct form, and maybe, I don't know whether this applies or not, the indirect form that you're describing. But I don't see why not. I mean, to me, it makes eminent sense. Canada is really, if America is water rich, Canada is super water rich. And as is part of Russia, although Russia has got water in places that are hard to get. The integration of our two resources on some kind of economical basis makes eminent sense to me. As long as we're using clean resource, why not? I mean, what do we care where it comes from?
Great.
You could edify me about the issue. Yeah.
I think Matthew's got a follow-up question, so I'm going to pass him back the mic just for a second to ask that follow-up question.
Yes, the issue for us here, I mean, we have a 5,500 megawatt dam that's been operating since the 70s. We're just starting in year two of construction of a 824 megawatt dam, and we've hosted every governor of New England, and they seem hesitant to want to import power from Canada on a large scale. And I guess it's a whole nationalistic American view that they want to be energy independent, and that seems to be putting a big stop to large scale imports. And what we're saying is we have the power. We're a jurisdiction of in my province of only 500,000 people with more hydropower than we can ever dream of using. So we want to export clean and renewable energy into the states.
A question that I would have is the basis for their objection. First of all, do you have the mechanisms through the electric? Do we have the electrical grid lines that could easily transfer that electricity in an efficient and reliable way? That would be question number one, because in more parts of the United States, we have a very old electrical grid system that desperately needs updating. And secondly, I'm familiar with New Hampshire pretty well and Vermont, which are not the most populous states, but they don't seem to be short of, they don't have a large population, and they seem to have a lot of water, run-of-river dams, so I don't know how big their needs are for further energy. That would be a second question.
Well, I'm going to pass it back to Matthew to see if he can address those, and then we'll move on to another question after that, because I know that Kevin Tabe has a question or two.
Yeah, I guess for us right now, we currently export into the spot market on a small level basis, but we just financed $5 billion to construct the generating facility and brand new transmission lines that will go to the island of Newfoundland, underwater to Nova Scotia, through New Brunswick, and with our partner, the Emera, who we're partnered in this project with, they own, obviously, they own Bangor Hydro and Emera Maine, which is Emera Maine now. So they have the transmission capacity to bring hydro power from our facility in northern Canada right down to the New England market. And that includes the construction of a new 1,100 megawatt underground cable proposed from Maine down to New Hampshire. So we're upgrading all the transmission lines, and that's our and that's what we've been telling every governor coming up here. Said we don't want you to invest a lot of money into this. We want to build all the infrastructure. We just want customers. There's right. still pushback on it.
Well, you'll get there if the price comes. If the price is competitive, then when they got to face a price of building a new dam that's pretty expensive, and they're going to have to tax their population to build it, I think they'll buy it from you. But I think it's a little like the case of that I was describing before at the Grand Coulee. You know, if it's a good resource, which it sounds like it is, it'll get there because the electricity demands in the United States are projected to increase, as I say, by the Department of Energy, at least 50%, I believe, in the next 30 or so years, depending on the region that we're talking about. So you're going to find the demand at some point, hopefully sooner rather than later. But
Steve, let me pass the mic to Kevin Tabe. Kevin's also one of our master's candidates, and I think he has a question for you.
I've been very interested in water. I did a thesis on water, but I looked at it from a humanized perspective back in 2006, I believe. My question is, do you have a model or some recommendations on this so-called paradigm on how to manage water? What recommendations would you have for states or governments to deal with the scarcity and things of that sort?
The answer is yes, sort of. I've been spending the last 3 years or so giving talks around the country and talking to water people in the water business, water experts, all the different elements. And I must say there is a kind of a consensus about that we need to start to look at watersheds as a totally integrated basis for all of the needs. There are ways in which we could use, in some cases, people we are recognizing, whether it's in Hurricane Katrina. After Hurricane Katrina, we learned a lot of lessons too. That we want that wetlands, let's say, serve a certain economic purpose as well, in absorbing water and protecting some of our infrastructures. There is forestation, you know, is being used to help, you know, reduce pollutants and that kind of thing. The reuse of water that's going on in the many of the metropolitan areas, particularly in the southwest, the areas that are facing water scarcity. Some of the things that the corporations are doing, both to get more efficient. There's a whole. There's not a single. How will I describe it? It is the answer to this new paradigm. The answer. So there is a consensus of opinion around the family of in the toolkit, if you will, of tools that we can use. Now, in each case, there's not going to be a one size fits all paradigm. The way you did kind of at Hoover, you know, Dam gave you a new paradigm that everybody could easily sort of invest in and copy. Here you're going to have a toolkit of solutions that is going to look at the immediate and regional problems that you face, which are different everywhere because water everywhere presents itself in unique fashions and a set of opportunities as well as problems. But the suite of tools will be being drawn from, whether part of it might be, if you're on a coast, for example, desalination of water for urban populations, a high-value use that are based on a coast where you don't have to pump the water over long distances. That is a viable approach in those areas. It's not so viable when you talk about regions that are inland or are very high elevation. Because of the high energy costs, that raises the barrier in that particular case. But you're starting to get some water markets. So, for example, you have the opportunity, it's been suggested, I mean, Las Vegas has proposed that they pay California for some of the water that they take out of the Colorado River so that Las Vegas, which is inland and very water stressed, can get more water, and they would pay for a desalination plant in California. Well, that hasn't quite come to fruition yet, but it's conceivable, right? If, you know, the legal obstacles and the and all the passions over water can be managed. Another water-saving tool is going to be the genetically modified crops that use less water. There's a lot of issues surrounding that, and in certain areas, that may be a tool that can be used. Another thing that people are finding in basins where there's a conflict between salmon, for example, and farmers, which took place in the Oregon-California border area, the farmers discovered that they didn't need the water resources all year round. They needed it only at a particular time of year, but it had to be reliable. They needed it in that season that they actually, so they could, some of the water could be stored or let loose and let be used for in-stream purposes when it was not the season that they needed it, provided that they were guaranteed the water when they got it. So there is a toolkit. It's going to be very decentralized. It's going to be very applied on a kind of a basis that is particular to the region. Another big one, by the way, is cities looking at, it's happening around cities around the world, are looking at stormwater, you know, which has been rushing off, carrying pollutants and also wasting the water. So they've now coming with pervious concrete in cities like Philadelphia, Chicago, even starting here in Washington, D.C., not in Los Angeles, by the way, where they need it the most. And the water will seep into the ground and can be stored and not pollute and not be lost. These are obviously win-win approaches. They're costly, but they make eminent sense on multiple levels. So that really we need to look at this as a multiple-level chess board. And look at the right solutions in an interdisciplinary way.
I want to ask if anyone else has any other questions. Stephen, you've been absolutely kind to all of us by taking so much time and really working hard on answering these questions and thinking about these issues. So if anyone else with us has any questions, please let me know. You can just type them there in the chat box right above the your name. I'll read it off for you, or if you're a student in the program, instant message me and I'll hand you the mic. Well, I'm not seeing anybody typing any questions, and Stephen, I want to say thank you for taking the time.
And I'd like to echo that, Stephen. Your insights have been thought-provoking and I think quite profound, and I'm hopeful that some students out there will take up the issue of water usage and contribute, using some of Steve's insights, contribute to, I think, the not only the legal literature, but maybe perhaps the betterment of society to come up with some new ways to approach these issues and these new paradigms that we need.
And I can tell you, I'm going to see the folks at the Water Resources Board sometime soon. I'm not going to tell them the kind things that you said about them. But they do deserve it. You're exactly right.
Yeah, they do. I think they do.
They really do. Thank you so much for
and,
sharing.
And I'll confess to having been pleasantly surprised. I did not know. I was unaware, and I just had no idea, or very little idea of that. And they really were quite out front in this area. So it's a good model to start with for anybody who's local.
It really is a good model. You're exactly right. And I will share it with some folks. I do appreciate you having said that. They do amazing work and really manage the resources of our state very well. So, Stephen, thank you so much for this time. Our students may send you an email here or there. I hope that's okay. But we appreciate you greatly. Thank you.